This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. President Richard Nixon saw some notable achievements during his administration. There was the opening to China and steps toward détente with the Soviet Union. But Watergate and other dirty tricks clouded all. From the time Nixon took the oath of office until he realized his presidency was over, what was life like in the White House? How did that atmosphere affect foreign and domestic policy? These are questions journalist Richard Reeves takes up in his new book, President Nixon, Alone in the White House. Richard Nixon described himself as an introvert in an extrovert's business, and Reeves says Nixon was, in fact, always a man alone. The aloneness, the isolation, and other factors helped create a nasty atmosphere in the White House. It was an administration that locked out critical advisors, spied on itself, and was ultimately crushed by its deceptions. Listeners, your questions for Richard Reeves are welcome in Champaign-Urbana. Our number, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Syndicated columnist Richard Reeves is the author of a dozen books. He is a former chief political correspondent for the New York Times, and in the early 1980s, he covered the Muslim world for The New Yorker. His new book, President Nixon, Alone in the White House, is published by Simon & Schuster. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Richard Reeves, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Richard Nixon described himself as an introvert in an extrovert's business. So what led him to a life in politics?
I think that he was an extremely gifted man, intelligent, had great determination, discipline, great will. And I think that he felt he grew up in almost a Steinbeck kind of life in Southern California, in the orchards, when America was quite poor, and that part of America was quite poor. And his own intelligence was so high that he could understand a great deal about who was succeeding and what, why they succeeded. And he had great resentment toward that. He had great resentment toward things that, toward rich people. He was a, as it were, conservative populist, people who went to the right schools, people who dressed right, people who were, in his mind, always lucky. Later in life, he identified the Kennedys as that group of people. And he was going to get even. He was going to succeed on a level beyond anybody's imagination. It was almost as if he had decided he was going to be a star in the NBA, considering the qualifications he had in a business where most politicians I've known over my time are people who can't stand to be alone. And Richard Nixon couldn't stand to be with people. So it's one of the great triumphs of will and intelligence of a truly self-created man who made himself into President of the United States.
Mm. One of the things that the Nixon White House is known for today, the hours and hours of tape recordings that were made. And then, in addition to that, there are millions of pages of papers. Why did Richard Nixon make such a thorough record?
Well, Henry Kissinger, in one of the interviews we did in the process of doing this book, said, you've got to remember, it's a little self-serving, but then he always is, you've got to remember that the Nixon on the tapes is not the real Nixon. It's the Nixon on the paper. And he, like most of the politicians of that time, American politicians, modeled themselves after Winston Churchill. That is, they were going to make the history, and then they were going to write it. And Nixon's career was more naturally toward being a writer than being a politician. And he thought he could collect all of this material, 44 million pages in the archives, and use them after his retirement. He saw it as a retirement with great honors, and write a series of books, as did Churchill, on his life and times. And he was he was obviously compulsive and obsessive, and he just wanted to collect more and more, so that every meeting, everyone who met with Nixon in the White House had to submit a report on what had happened within 48 hours, a kind of Rashomon, addition to that, he had formed a cadre of people called the Anecdotalists, very talented people like Bill Sapphire, Pat Buchanan, Ray Price, who would stand in the corners to try to catch what he called the human interest, Nixon the man, his humor, his warmth. And he was going to take all of this and weave this multi-volume series about the great presidency of the greatest generation. And he used that phrase before Tom Brokaw did.
He would have needed, it seems to me, a stadium full of editors to get this job done.
He didn't realize that. And I think, frankly, that when he found that out was when he erased, and I assume he did, the 18 and a half minutes on a tape and realized how long that took to do. And suddenly he realized that this volume of material could never be perused by one man. And I must add, it's a hell of a problem if you're trying to write a book about him, too, because I'm only one man.
Right. I was going to ask you, with so much primary source material available, where did you begin? How did you go about this project?
I began basically by doing interviews. I had done a similar book on Kennedy, trying to describe the presidency from the center. And you begin really with interviews of people who were there, with kind of reading the papers and magazines of the period to triangulate on things you know must have happened. Suddenly certain days or certain events you realize were critical, and then you dive into the archives at that point to see what there is on paper, and then go back and interview people, the same people maybe who directed you there, about what really happened. And a funny part of what I do, and I'm sure other people, the Michael Beschlosses, David McCulloughs, David Halberstams of the world, get to a point very quickly where they know more about, because it's fresher in their minds, know more about what some people did in certain circumstances than they know themselves.
Hmm. There are insights here into Nixon's personality. He was a man who seemed always to be writing scripts and memorizing lines, and you came across these documents that were sort of like legal pads or sheets of legal paper. How did you find those memos, those scripts that Nixon was constantly writing for himself, to himself?
Well, sometimes I think it was sheer roaring luck, but it was bad luck in a way for him. Nixon left the presidency, as we know, in a disorderly manner. That is, he didn't have time to collect his stuff and pack his bags. It was all seized by the FBI at the time. So that on the August day in 1974, when he left the White House at midnight that night, his secretary and her assistants went to the three desks that he kept, one in the Oval Office, one in the Executive Office Building, and one in the study that Abraham Lincoln used upstairs in the living quarters, and they emptied everything in them into boxes and sealed those boxes, and those boxes stayed sealed for decades. And what they mainly were these long yellow pad lists, as you said, of memos to himself, of kind of New Year's resolutions, but doing it every day, and of dictation on dictabelts about the man he wanted to be, the president he wanted to be, and what he hoped he could do with all of that. And with a man that introverted, a man who could not understand social cues, those dialogues with himself were the most important dialogues in the White House. And when I began to read them, I was just stunned. I mean, he began, as you or I would begin, I mean, he didn't certainly set out to say, boy, what can I do to hurt America? I mean, the man wanted to be a great president. And his very first lines in those were compassionate, bold, new, courageous, zest for the job, not lonely but awesome, goals, reorganized government, idea magnet. These were all little notes to himself. Open channels for dissent. And then as time went on, he became more and more closed and more internal, and he would be writing notes like, as if he were planning a coup against his own government. Above all, don't let them break through and see what kind of man new RN is. Maintain mystery. And he did maintain mystery and tried to govern by surprise. But it's an extraordinary and unique description of a president, as an extraordinarily interesting one, as he saw himself.
If Nixon was a man always writing scripts, always rehearsing conversations and the like in private, was he a man who was always prepared in terms of his goals as president in foreign and domestic policy?
Well, he certainly was almost always prepared, particularly on foreign. He memorized almost every word he said in public. He had great powers of memorization. Len Garment, who had been a professional musician, said he thought he learned it. He, Nixon, learned it because he had learned as a small boy to play hundreds of pieces on the piano, though he could read not a note of music, so that he literally memorized everything that he did in public. There were scripts, but also in one-on-one conversations. He also, because he was so socially awkward, would memorize what he would say. I mean, one of the records I came across, not important, but was an 8-page memorandum on a script for a 10-minute conversation he was going to have with the singer Pearl Bailey. And he stuck to those scripts and was comfortable as long as he could do that. If he couldn't do that, he then turned into this introverted fellow who couldn't read other people and didn't know what to say or do.
So unlike Kennedy. So unlike Bill
totally
Clinton.
Totally unlike Kennedy, yeah. Or Clinton, yes.
Nixon.
They couldn't bear to be alone.
Yeah.
He couldn't bear people.
Oh. Nixon's closest advisors were Kissinger, his head of the National Security Agency, Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, and John Ehrlichman, who was a domestic counselor. How important were these men to Nixon, and how did they all fit together?
Well, sometimes uncomfortably. One of the great discoveries I made was the excised parts of Haldeman's diaries, which were mostly about Haldeman as a go-between between Kissinger and Nixon. And ironically, in those notes, which were never seen until I found them, Nixon comes off much better than Kissinger. But in the end, I mean, Nixon was the one. He picked those people, and although Kissinger stayed through, when he lost Haldeman and Ehrlichman, basically because of the Watergate cover-up, he was able to replace them with other people, with Alexander Haig and with Ron Ziegler, who could function as extensions of the man himself. And they would kind of, in a Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside way, he was always Mr. Inside, and had to have people who could deal with what to most of us seemed like the ordinary business of an office, but to Nixon, they were almost impossible for him to do.
Mm. And Haldeman, it was his job to keep the president the way the president wanted to be, alone.
Yes, he was. He was a fierce guardian of the doorway of the Oval Office, and fiercer as time went on, and Nixon wanted to see fewer and fewer people. He also was a kind of, Bob Haldeman was kind of a pre-computer organizational genius, so that for someone like me coming along all these years later, he had, before the 1972 election, Haldeman had vetted the White House files and created a new thing called the Special White House File, which was what Nixon intended to take with him when he left office. It was the sensitive stuff, the classified stuff, the embarrassing stuff, and other presidents before him had done that. And those were the rules at that time, that these were personal papers. But in Nixon's case, because of Watergate, they were seized by the FBI and moved eventually into the National Archives, so that when someone like me came along 30 years later, the real stuff was there, not the stuff they normally would have hided. So you get a quite extraordinary picture of of the way the White House was working and the way the president was thinking.
Mm. What does Haldeman have to say about the man Richard Nixon in his writings that are in the archives?
I think he writes of him. That's a very interesting question. He writes of him as a this kind of curious fellow who sometimes seems to Haldeman almost have rays coming from his eyes when he's succeeding as president. The extraordinary power that one man could control so much. And then on the other hand, and most of these things were excised, he had these wonderfully funny stories, and Haldeman was not a man of great humor, about the way Nixon operated and thought and what he thought the presidency was. He has a wonderful, one of the excised segments was a wonderful story of the first state dinner that Nixon had. He was only in office a couple of months, and the dinner was for Pierre Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. And after it was over, he said to Haldeman, "These dinners are too long, and we should eliminate a course. Let's eliminate the soup course." Haldeman then heads off for the kitchen to tell them, basically, you know, we're not going to have a soup course at the next dinner. And he bumps into the president's valet, a man named Manolo Sanchez, and says, "Manolo, did anything happen last night at the dinner that was unusual, as you saw it?" And Sanchez said, "Well, the president spilled soup all over his vest." And so Haldeman then went back to Nixon and said, "You know, I don't know that we have to eliminate the soup course, et cetera." And Nixon cut him off and he said, "Real men don't eat soup." And it was never served again for the next 6 years.
Yeah.
But it was that kind of trivia to great affairs of state, with Henry Kissinger rushing in quite incorrectly. Kissinger was often hysterical, and Nixon was often trying to get him to see psychiatrists, saying the Russians will attack within 72 hours. We must be ready, Mr. President, or the world will think you're a weakling. Mm-hmm. Well, the Russians didn't invade, and at times Nixon would say, "You got to keep this guy away from me, or we've got to get him a doctor." So it was quite a scene in this house of secrets.
Mm. The president ordered a secret bombing campaign in Cambodia that got underway in March of 69. And in May, the New York Times broke the story, and Kissinger, you write, was beside himself.
Well, that was what began the phone tapping,
right,
by the White House side, because Kissinger was hysterical about what would happen when William Beecher of the New York Times, who had been there and had seen the bombs, wrote that story. The story actually had no impact whatever. There was no follow-up to it. They continued bombing for a year. After it, more bombs than were dropped on Europe in World War II. But it all, keeping that secret, Nixon wanted to govern by surprise. Charles de Gaulle was his idol, and de Gaulle was great at springing surprises on the French people, and Nixon became great at doing it with us. One night he appears on television and says that he's going to go to China, where no American has gone. Another time he gets on television at night and says he's taking the U.S. off the gold standard, devaluating the dollar, and completely changing the economic systems of the world. Very close to what we have now. He really created globalization. But by doing it by surprise, there was never any public debate or hint of debate about these momentous decisions, and that's exactly the way he wanted it. But for that kind of surprise, you've got to keep everything secret. And to keep everything secret, you have to lie. And as the lies pile one upon the other, other people in the administration began to spy on the White House, as the White House was spying on them, to try to find out what was going on. They could not find, the Secretary of Defense, Mel Laird, could not find out what Nixon and Kissinger were actually doing, so that the Defense Department tapped the president's phone, tapped Kissinger's phone, sent spies into the White House who would bring everything in the wastebaskets in the early morning hours over the Pentagon so the generals and admirals could pore through them, and literally photographed every paper every night in Henry Kissinger's briefcase so that these people could have a sense of what it was the government, which they seemed to be such high officials of, was actually doing. And then that chaos of untruth led them to distrust the president to the extent that in September of 1970, five American planes were hijacked by Palestinians and flown to an airfield, an abandoned World War II airfield in Jordan. And Nixon's immediate reaction, very similar to today, was to have jets from the aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf hit Palestinian positions in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon. And before the order got to Laird, it was transmitted through Kissinger. Laird already knew what the order was because of his spies in the White House, and he called the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Thomas Moore, and he said, "Tom, for the next 48 hours, there's going to be bad weather over the Gulf, and no planes will be able to fly." And in fact, the president's order came to fly the planes. No planes ever flew, and 48 hours later, the situation was different. And the difference in the situation was the Jordanians were defeating the Palestine Liberation Army in street fighting in Jordan, so that it never happened. But that was not a terribly unusual occasion in the Nixon White House. It was a nest of people who could no longer unravel the lies, who no longer knew what the truth was. And in the end, the president himself didn't know what the truth was.
So from the very early going, we're on track for Watergate.
We were on track for Watergate from at the earliest, February and March of 1969. And what secrecy and lying can do to you was played out in an extraordinary string of events, which began when a Vietnamese soldier found a roll of film on a dead Viet Cong in the Mekong Delta. And the film showed what appeared to be a meeting of high officials, high North Vietnamese officials, in the jungles of Cambodia. And one man, they could not recognize one man in those photos, but he appeared to be a man named Nguyen, who was the chief interpreter and a spy for the Green Berets in Vietnam. And they arrested him, arrested Nguyen, and questioned him heavily, but they couldn't prove that he was a double agent. And they went to the CIA, the Green Berets did, Colonel Robert Rowe, who was the model for the Marlon Brando character in Apocalypse Now, went to the CIA and got the impression, perhaps, from the CIA that they should get rid of the guy. And they did get rid of him. They killed him that night and threw his body into the South China Sea. When it became clear at some point, the CIA tried to cover itself by immediately saying it had not, these are all internal things, covering itself, and went to Creighton Abrams, the commander, who called in Rowe and was convinced that Rowe was lying. Rowe said the man was still alive, and had six Green Berets arrested. They were about to be court-martialed when the White House found out about it, and Nixon and Kissinger immediately interceded, and the reason they interceded was Nguyen's job was target selection and damage evaluation in Cambodia, so that in a court-martial, it would inevitably come out that we were bombing Cambodia, which the American people didn't know, so that after much effort, Kissinger got Helms, Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, to order CIA agents not to testify at the court-martial in the interest of national security. Helms said there was no national security, but they leaned on him and got him to do it. It was exactly the pattern they tried to do in Watergate. When Colonel Rowe and the rest were released, a former analyst in Vietnam, now resident in Santa Monica at the Rand Institute, Daniel Ellsberg, saw a one-paragraph statement in the New York Times that the court-martial had been called off. He was convinced at that moment that Nixon did not intend to end the war in Vietnam, and that was the moment, that day, that he called his friend Tony Russo and said, "Do you know anybody with a Xerox machine?" and took the Pentagon Papers out of the safe at Rand and began to photocopy them, which became, of course, the Pentagon Papers, and the release of the Pentagon Papers led to the formation of the Plumbers Union to plug leaks in the White House. And one of the things they did, among the burglaries that involved not only with the Watergate burglary, but the burglary of Dr. Fielding, Lewis Fielding, who was Ellsberg's psychiatrist. And so suddenly, the presidency was over when people began to discover this. But the cover-up plans on other outrages, I guess, assassination in Chile and other places, began to unravel when the CIA would no longer stand up and say this was national security.
We have some listeners waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Our guest today, Richard Reeves, we're talking with him about his book, President Nixon, Alone in the White House. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's go first to a listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. I take it from what you said at the beginning, and I'm certainly inclined to agree that Nixon was what you'd call a loner type, and there really never have been many presidents, at least none that I can think of, that were really in that category. Usually you think of a loner as somebody who becomes a writer or a pot maker or an artist or something of that sort. Even Calvin Coolidge, who was taciturn, was not exactly what you'd call a loner type. I mean, isn't that right?
Where would you put Wilson?
Oh, I think Woodrow Wilson, well, he was an intellectual, but he certainly wasn't a loner type.
Okay.
I think he was gregarious. What I wondered about Nixon is I think that the nature of him must have been pretty apparent from fairly early on. So one wonders how he was able to get up the ladder, so to speak, because it seems like he would have been an odd choice for Eisenhower as vice president, and then an odd choice again when he ran in 1960. He didn't seem to be the popular type of person that Americans usually look for in a president. So there must be something that accounts for his success in getting to the top of the ladder. And I just wonder what you think might account for that.
Well, I think that it was a tremendous triumph of personal will and intelligence, and that he learned politics happened to be the field he studied. You're quite right, by the way. He was meant to be a writer or a college professor. And he learned how to be a politician by mimicking politicians. When he was, he had some luck along the way. The Eisenhower thing was kind of luck. Eisenhower once went to visit Nixon, was in the hospital a couple of days for something. And when he came back, he said to his secretary, a woman named Ann Whitman, "You know, I can't understand it." She said, "Dick has no friends. No one else has come to the hospital." And Ann Whitman didn't say anything, but that night in her diary, she wrote that the president, Ike, doesn't understand that Nixon is not a nice man. He's someone finding out how to pretend to be a nice man, so that part of his memorization and had to do with a kind of emotional memorization of how people interacted with each other. And he, as well as he did that, and he did it very well, learn how to be other people, it didn't serve him well enough that he was comfortable being with people, and he often would say and do rather bizarre things because it was learned behavior. However, he learned to memorize on that level. One of the reasons he had so few press conferences was he would memorize 500 answers. Then he would go in this relatively hostile room with reporters who didn't much like him and try to deal with them. And then it would take him 2 or 3 days. He'd go to Camp David or someplace else. He rarely slept under the same roof for more than 3 or 4 nights at a time and kind of crash from this incredible effort. So it wasn't so much the hostility of the press, which was quite real. It was the energy it took him to do these things. And he was actually a man of rather low energy who could only focus for 3 or 4 hours a day, then would take naps secretly, and maybe come back and work for a day or two. When he was prepared and had memorized a script, he could be an extremely formidable presence, but that took enormous effort and discipline on his part to act out this role he was totally unprepared for emotionally or neurologically or intellectually.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I'm going to go on now to someone else who's been waiting to talk with us this afternoon. This is a caller on the toll-free line in Taylorville. Good afternoon.
When I think of Tricky, I think of that clever 18th century French fellow who observed le ciel, c'est le même l'homme même. The man himself, the style is the man himself. And then I reflect back on how he got started with those smear campaigns in California against Helen Gehig and Douglas and Jerry Voorhees. He really matured as a president. That Chilean business, the overthrowing of an elected a student democracy. And this leads me to reflect that all these conspiracies of his sort of reflect what our government is and has been for quite some time, and what our system of government is. It's about 11 or 12 parts of plutocracy, maybe with a couple of rah-rahs thrown in after the first rah in plutocracy.
I think we've got the gist of your point of view there, and I'm going to ask Richard Reeves if you'd like to respond, Mr. Reeves.
I didn't follow that. I had trouble following it.
Oh. Well, I think that we can put the caller back up here for a moment, but I think that this caller we have some familiarity with him, and he is he's pretty much down on the government. Period.
Yeah. And well, Nixon did a lot of that.
Yeah, and Nixon is probably among his top 10 worst guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I would respond to that, we don't pay presidents, by the hour. We pay them for the big ones where their judgment is necessary, as George Bush's now is. The biggest single part of the job of being president in a democracy as great as this is to bring out the best in the people. George Bush will succeed if he can do that. Nixon failed in the end, though he had many great achievements, because he brought out the worst in the American people, and he, more than anyone else, was responsible for what became the great distrust of government and distrust of our own systems, if that's responsive to what the gentleman was saying.
That leads me to ask you this question. President Bush is enjoying great popularity at the moment in this country. What's your assessment of his performance over the last month?
Well, I see him as the kind of graduate student in residence. That my assessment would be on the positive side, because I believe in his public appearances, particularly before the Congress, he was adequate and then some in understanding that it is not the government or him who makes America great and will make it possible to deal with this, but the people themselves. I think, we have been, I don't like to use that phrase, asleep at the switch that everyone is using, but we elected 2 southwestern governors to be president after people like Kennedy, who never mentioned domestic policy in his inaugural address, Nixon, who considered domestic policy, in his own words, as building outhouses in Peoria. Well, actually, George Bush and Bill Clinton did build outhouses in their own Peoria, so that they were essentially totally unprepared for the way the world really was, and believed their own rhetoric about the only superpower, the only essential nation. And I think that Bush deserves a good deal of credit for what has got to be riding one of the greatest learning curves in White House history as he tries to figure out how to deal with this. And, you know, we're kind of obligated to give him room to find out as long as he performs well in public. And I think he has, although the unintended consequences of the policies could be tremendous. It's going to take a terrible or a tremendous sophistication. I mean, let's say we overthrow the Taliban, which I think we will. Where do they go? Well, they're going to go to Pakistan. It's the only place they can go. And what happens if they then, with fundamentalist Muslims already in Pakistan, try to take over that country, which has, I might add, nuclear weapons, and has one overriding enemy in their own minds, India? What could all this lead to? And the president and the people he trusts have got to evaluate each one of these possible effects as they make policy. And obviously, he was not prepared, educated, or experienced in doing that. But he has managed to at least show the public a kind of relative of calm and understanding about how far we can go and can't go in this situation. Mm. And hopefully, he will continue to grow. I mean, I see him as coming to office as a boy, and now he is becoming a man, I hope.
What do you make of his team, the men and women of this presidency?
I think he has good people. The Republicans have controlled the presidency for 20 out of the last 32 years, so they have a pretty deep bench. And while I may not admire all of his people equally, it's a pretty good team. It's better than a wild card team in the playoffs, and people have had a lot of experience. He's also got his father and Brent Scowcroft and people around who have been through things something like this. There's never been anything exactly like this. Presidents are trained and governments are designed to deal with politicians and with soldiers. Well, politicians are creatures of compromise. Soldiers are quite predictable in the way they respond to events. But these terrorists, or Osama bin Laden himself, are not soldiers, and they are not politicians by any means. And it's going to take a great deal of creativity to figure out how do you actually deal with people like this, and should we kill or cage Osama bin Laden, which I think we will. There are going to be others. It's going to take a long time to suck this poison, and a great deal of sophistication to suck this poison out of the world.
As we go along, for example, President Bush is going to hold a news conference this evening. But as we go along, there's been some signals that the government is going to hold some things back and not keep us totally up to date on what's going on and where the efforts are and what they've done and what they've got planned, which seems to me to be kind of a tricky landscape in order to rally us around, yet win what's called the war on terrorism.
Well, we are rallied around. I mean, Americans rally around the flag very quickly, which is why the president has a 90% and 95% approval rating. The military, this is my opinion. The military tries to control information as they try to control everything else. Most of us probably remember when we developed a great record the great weapon, the Patriot missile, and then a year later it came out that no Patriot missile ever hit anything at all. Clearly, the military knew that at the time and deliberately misled the public on that. And as it happened in the Nixon White House, the morality and the momentum of democracy seems we always pay a high price for every single lie. So to the extent we aren't being given the truth on these things, it will lead to unintended and probably unpleasant consequences. But I suppose if you or I were in their position, they want very much to control the information to give themselves freedom. I mean, it's extraordinary that the president for a time, well, it was extraordinary in terms of ignorance that the president used the word crusade early on, and now the talking about not letting the Congress know, much less the public or the press, know, is what used to be called un-American. And if we go in those directions, we will pay an extremely high price. We will lose faith in ourselves, in the democracy, and in the nation itself, as we did at the end of the Nixon years.
Richard Reeves, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Sorry to say we're out of time.
Thank you. I probably talked too long, but I appreciate your being interested. Thank you.
Good talking with you. Richard Reeves has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is President Nixon Alone in the White House. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Richard Reeves is a journalist, a syndicated columnist, the author of a dozen books. He's a former chief political correspondent for the New York Times, and in the early 1980s, he covered the Muslim world for the New Yorker. Among his film projects, the PBS Frontline documentary Red Star Over Khyber won the Peabody Award.